Welcome back. Please, I hope you have taken action, wrote those things down that I need you to write down because they're very important. And we're going to go ahead and learn about the power of habit, the habit loop. Right now we're in the commit, reprogramming your mindset and beliefs portion of the four-step process of 3 C's of change. And within that, we learn about cues and habits. Now, I want to share with you an awesome book. It's called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business by Charles Duhigg. I actually sent an email to the author because it's so powerful what I learned about myself and about habits and cues and triggers. So that's why I said I wanted you to write down some of the triggers, some of the cues, because we make decisions, and you'll learn in this next segment here, you'll make decisions without even knowing that these decisions are automatic. And that's what creates a habit, where you don't have to necessarily interject. It becomes ingrained, so to speak, in your cerebral. So I want everything in your environment to be set up for success, and all these little cues and triggers so you can manually step in and say, hey, no. You know, If I do this, if I go down this street, it's most likely I'll go to that ATM at that bank, right? If I look up this on the website, if I look up these things on the website, or if I get mailings in the mail from these casinos that says, hey, free two nights at the Borgata, free two nights at Harrah's, wherever you gamble, it's those triggers that must be removed. And it's going to take some conscious effort, but because automatic decision-making, where you have no control of, no part of, no authority over, that's happening automatically. So right now we have to battle that, combat it with a forceful, manual, almost interjectory behavior. Oh, no, I just noticed that. Boom, I'm going to stop. I'm going to turn it. And I'm going to make something happen. So another great resource, and this resource is not mine, but I really love it enough to share it with you guys, is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And that book, I have it down below, and you could just click it. It's on Amazon. And I love the author. I love what he created here. And it has helped me understand why I did what I did. So now I would like to put it in front of you and give that to you and teach you. And maybe some of you guys know this, but there was a gentleman named Eugene in 1993. There was a doctor. There was a doctor in San Diego, and he scheduled an appointment with Eugene. Eugene was an elderly, shade over 6 feet tall, neatly dressed, blue button-down shirt. He walks in, and he doesn't even know where he's going. He doesn't know what's the next step because he kind of lost his memory with an injury, and it's a very rare injury, and we're going to learn about that injury here. But a year earlier, so 1992, Eugene, as he would come to be known in medical literature, had been home in Playa del Rey. So this is when it happened, the injury, right? Preparing for dinner when his wife mentioned that their son, Michael, was coming over. And then Eugene answered, who's Michael? And she's like, your child. You know, the one we raised? Eugene stared at her blankly, like, who is that? The next day, Eugene started vomiting and writhing. And with stomach cramps, within 24 hours, his dehydration was so pronounced that a panicked Beverly, his wife's name, Beverly took him to the emergency room. His temperature started rising, hitting 105 degrees as he sweated a yellow halo of perspiration onto the hospital sheets. He became delirious, then violent, yelling and pushing when nurses tried to insert an IV into his arm. Only after sedation was a physician able to slide a long needle between two vertebrae in a small of his back and extract a few drops of cerebrospinal fluid. The doctor performing the procedure sensed trouble immediately. The fluid surrounding the brain and spinal nerves is a barrier against infection and injury. In healthy individuals, it is clear and quick-flowing, moving with an almost silky rush through a needle. The sample from Eugene's spine was cloudy and dripped out sluggishly as it filled with microscopic grit. When the results came back from the laboratory, Eugene's physicians learned why he was ill. He was suffering from viral encephalitis, a disease caused by relatively harmless virus that produces cold sores, fever blisters, and mild infections on the skin. In rare cases, however, the virus can make its way into the brain, inflicting catastrophic damage as it chews through the delicate folds of tissues where our thoughts, dreams, and according to some, souls reside. Eugene's doctors told Beverly there was nothing they could do to counter the damage already done, but a large dose of antiviral drugs might prevent it from spreading. Eugene slipped into a coma and for 10 days was close to death. Gradually, as the drugs fought the disease, his fever receded and the virus disappeared. When he finally awoke, he was weak and disoriented and couldn't swallow properly. He couldn't form sentences and would sometimes gasp as if he had momentarily forgot how to breathe. But he was alive. Eventually, Eugene was well enough for a battery of tests. The doctors were amazed to find that his body, including his nervous system, appeared largely unscathed. He could move his limbs and was responsive to noise and light. Scans of his head, though, revealed ominous shadows near the center of his brain. The virus had destroyed an oval of tissue close to where his cranium and spinal column met. "He might not be the person you remember," one doctor warned Beverly. "You need to be ready if your husband is gone." Eugene was moved into a different wing of the hospital. Within a week, he was swallowing easily. Another week, he started talking normally, asking for Jell-O and salt, flipping through television channels and complaining about boring soap operas. By the time he was discharged to a rehabilitation center 5 weeks later, Eugene was walking down hallways and offering nurses unsolicited advice about their weekend plans. "I don't think I've ever seen anyone come back like this," doctor told Beverly. "I don't want to raise your hopes, but this is amazing." Beverly, however, remained concerned. In the rehab hospital, it became clear that the disease had changed her husband in unsettling ways. Eugene couldn't remember which day of the week it was, for instance, or the names of the doctors and nurses, no matter how many times they introduced themselves. "Why do they keep asking me all these questions?" he asked Beverly one day after a physician left his room. When he finally returned home, things got even stranger. Eugene didn't seem to remember their friends. He had trouble following conversations. Some mornings he would get out of bed, walk into the kitchen, cook himself bacon and eggs, then climb back under the covers and turn on the radio. 40 minutes later, he would do the same thing. Get up, cook bacon and eggs, climb back into the bed and fiddle with the radio. Then he wouldn't do it again. Alarmed, Beverly reached out to specialists, including a researcher at the University of California, San Diego, who specialized in memory loss, which is now, on a sunny fall day, Beverly and Eugene found themselves in a nondescript building on the university's campus, holding hands as they walked slowly down a hallway. They were shown into a small exam room. Eugene began chatting with a young woman who was using the computer. "Having been in electronics for over the years, I'm amazed at all this," he said, gesturing at the machine she was typing on. "When I was younger, that thing would have been a couple of 6-foot racks and taken up the whole room." The woman continued pecking at the keyboard. Eugene chuckled. "That is incredible," he said. "All those printed circuits and diodes and triodes. When I was in electronics, there would have been a couple of 6-foot racks holding that thing." A scientist entered the room and introduced himself. He asked Eugene how old he was. "Oh, let's see, 50, 90, or 60, Eugene replied. He was 71 years old. The scientist started typing on the computer. Eugene smiled and pointed at it. "That is really something," he said. "You know, when I was in electronics, there would have been a couple of six-foot racks holding that thing." The scientist was 52-year-old Larry Squire, a professor who had spent the past three decades studying a neuroanatomy of memory. His specialty was exploring how the brain stores events. His work with Eugene, however, would soon open up a new world to him and hundreds of other researchers who have reshaped our understanding of how habits function. Squire's studies would show that even someone who can't remember his own age or almost anything else can develop habits that seem unconceivably complex until you realize that everyone relies on similar neurological processes every day. His and others' research would have revealed the subconscious mechanism that impacts the countless choices that seem as if they're the products of well-reasoned thoughts, but actually they are influenced by urges most of us barely recognize or understand. By the time Squire met Eugene, he had already been studying images of his brain for weeks. The scans indicated that almost all the damage within Eugene's skull was limited to a 5-centimeter area near the center of his head. The virus had almost entirely destroyed his medial temporal lobe, a sliver of cells that scientists suspected was responsible for all sorts of cognitive tasks, such as recall of the past and regulation of some emotions. The completeness of the destruction didn't surprise Squire. Viral encephalitis consumes tissue with a ruthless, almost surgical precision. What shocked him was how familiar the images seemed. Now, he goes on to say here in the story that he remembered this, the scientist remembered about 30 years ago as a student in MIT. He worked alongside another person, HM. His name was Henry Malazan. And he was hit by a bicycle and landed hard on his head. Soon afterward, he developed seizures and started blacking out. At 16, he had his first grand mal seizure, the kind that affects the entire brain. Soon he was losing consciousness up to 10 times a day. By the time he turned 27, HM was desperate. Henry was desperate. Anti-compulsive drugs hadn't helped. He was smart, but couldn't hold a job. He still lived with his parents. HM wanted a normal experience, so he sought help from a physician whose tolerance for experimentation outweighed his fear of malpractice. Studies have suggested that an area of his brain called the hippocampus might play a role in seizures. When the doctor proposed cutting into HM's head, lifting the whole front portion of his brain, and with a small straw sucking the hippocampus and some surrounding tissue from the interior of his skull, HM gave consent. That surgery occurred in 1953. HM healed. His seizures slowed almost immediately. However, it became clear that his brain had been radically altered. HM knew his name and that his mother was from Ireland. He could remember the 1929 stock market crash and news reports about the invasion of Normandy, but almost everything that came afterward, all his memories, experience, and struggles from most of the decade before his surgery, had been erased. When a doctor began testing HM's memory by showing him playing cards and listed numbers, he discovered that HM couldn't retain any new information for more than 20 seconds or so. From the day of his surgery until his death in 2008, every person HM met, every song he heard, every room he entered was completely fresh experience. His brain was frozen in time. Each day he was befuddled by the fact that someone could change the television channel by pointing a black rectangle of plastic at the screen. He introduced himself to his doctors and nurses over and over, dozens of times each day. Scientist says here, I love learning about HM because memory seemed like such a tangible, exciting way to study the brain. Squire told me, I grew up in Ohio, and I can't remember in first grade my teacher handing everyone crayons. He said he can remember that. And I started mixing all the colors together to see if it would make black. Why have I kept that in memory, but I can't remember what my teacher looked like? Why does my brain decide that one memory is more important than the other? When Squire received images of Eugene's brain, he marveled at how similar it seemed to HM's. There were empty walnut-sized chunks in the middle of both their heads. Eugene's memory, just like HM's, had been removed. And we're going to move here. We're going to move further in the story. And this is great. And yes, I'm going to get to a point. for those, hey, what does it have to do with my gambling? It has everything to do with that gambling. Because here's the thing about Eugene. So here's the main story I want to get to, the part that really is going to make sense for you in terms of understanding these cues and triggers. And we're going to get back into the story now. And just pay attention to what is happening here, what these cues are saying, okay? In the first few weeks after they moved into their new house, this is Eugene and Beverly. Beverly tried to take Eugene outside each day. The doctors had told her that it was important for him to get exercise, and if Eugene was inside too long, he drove Beverly crazy, asking her the same questions over and over in an endless loop. So each morning and afternoon, she took him on a walk around the block, always together and always along the same route. The doctors had warned Beverly that she would need to monitor Eugene constantly. If he ever got lost, they said, he would never be able to find his way home. But one morning, while she was getting dressed, Eugene slipped out the front door. He had a tendency to wander from room to room, so it took her a while to notice he was gone. When she did, she became frantic. She ran outside and scanned the street. She couldn't see him. She went to the neighbor's house and pounded on the windows. Their homes looked similar. Maybe Eugene had become confused and had gone inside. She ran to the door and rang the bell until someone answered. Eugene wasn't there. She sprinted back to the street, running up the block, screaming Eugene's name. She was crying. What if he wandered into traffic? How would he tell anyone where he lived? She had been outside for 15 minutes already, looking everywhere. She ran home to call the police. When she burst through the door, she found Eugene in the living room, sitting in front of the television, watching the History Channel. Her tears confused him. He didn't remember leaving, he said. Didn't know where he had been, and couldn't understand why she was so upset. Then Beverly saw a pile of pine cones on the table, like the ones she'd seen in the neighbor's yard down the street. She came closer and looked at Eugene's hands. His fingers were sticky with sap. That's when she realized that Eugene had gone for a walk by himself. He had wandered down the street and collected some souvenirs, and he had found his way home. Soon, Eugene was going for walks every morning. Beverly tried to stop him, but it was pointless. Even if I'm told to stay inside, he would remember a few minutes later, she told him. I followed him a few times to make sure he wouldn't get lost, but he always came back. Sometimes we'll return with pine cones or rocks. Once he came back with a wallet, another time with a puppy. He never remembered where they came from. When Squire, the scientist, and his assistants heard about these walks, they started to suspect that something was happening inside of Eugene's head that didn't have anything to do with his conscious memory. They designed an experiment. One of Squire's assistants visited the house one day and asked Eugene to draw a map of the block where he lived. He couldn't do it. How about where his house was located on the street, she asked. He doodled a bit, then forgot the assignment. She asked him to point out which doorway led to the kitchen. Eugene looked around the room. He didn't know. She asked Eugene what he would do if he were hungry. He stood up, walked into the kitchen, opened the cabinet, and took down a jar of nuts. Later that week, a visitor joined Eugene on his daily stroll. They walked for about 15 minutes through the perpetual spring of Southern California. The scent of oleanders heavy in the air. Eugene didn't say much, but he always led the way and seemed to know where he was going. He never asked for directions. As they rounded the corner near his house, the visitor asked Eugene where he lived. I don't know exactly, he said. Then he walked up to his sidewalk, opened his front door, went into the living room, and turned on the television. It was clear to Squire, the scientist, that Eugene was absorbing new information. But where inside his brain was that information residing? How could he, someone, find a jar of nuts when he couldn't say where the kitchen was located? Or find his way home when he had no idea which house was his? How Squire wondered where new patterns forming inside Eugene's damaged brain. And that, my friend, is the habit loop. The way that Eugene was able to go back home was through cues. So the tree was there. Notice that maybe that fence was there. Maybe the color of that house. And then he knew how to turn the corner at that point. The pine cones on the floor. The smell, the roses, the brush. See, if anything changed, Eugene was walking on a automatic behavior. He was not using memory. He was going from cues and triggers. If anything changed, if anything disrupt, maybe if they were having road work done, he would be completely lost. And this is what I'm talking about when I say addiction. And I read that book during my recovery. So that's why I love it so much, because it made sense to me how these cues and habits were formed. At first, they started off as cue, feeling good, getting that rush, getting that feeling inside my belly the first time, the second time. And now that feeling was all I needed to know that I needed to go to the casino. It was no longer my choice, no longer your choice. So that's why I said, write down those cues and habits and the loops and the triggers, because, and here's how you remove a habit. You keep the same cue, all right? You keep the same cue. And at this point, we're going to have the same cues, right? We're going to have the feeling. We're going to get the money in our hand. We're going to touch something. We're going to pass somewhere. Someone's going to say something. Something's in our mailbox. It's going to be our cue, the feeling we get, okay? And then the reward. What is the reward? The thought of fulfilling something, the thought of winning, the thought of having a good time, the thought of relieving stress, the thought of something was your reward. That's why we kept going. We are creatures of habit, right? So what you have to do and do this part is change the routine. Change the routine. See, now that you know your cues, and you might have to really take some time to think about these cues and to think about what your reward is. So what you have to do is change the routine. When you get that feeling in your gut, when you touch something and you start saying, oh shit, this is it, then why don't you go to the gym? Why don't you open up a book and read? See, you're looking for that same reward, changing the routine with that same cue. That's how you change the habit. You're going to do this over and over. And what I'd done is I knew I needed to quit. I knew I needed to stop. I had no money, first of all. I mean, I was going down a ruthless road of despair and a ruthless road of just like lying and cheating and stuff like that. I didn't want it anymore. So I knew my cue. My cue was when I started rubbing my two fingers together, and I had there was the multiple cues. Like, I had some money, I'm rubbing my fingers together, and I'm gonna find my way there. I'm going to make sure, I don't care, I get out of work at 2, okay, I'm going in this bitch at 3, okay, you're gonna see me there. So what I did is when I started rubbing my fingers, I knew that I had, that was the cue. So I'm not gonna change that because I can't change that right now. So what I'm gonna do is change the routine. I won't go to the casino. I won't go gamble. I won't go on a manhunt for money. What I'm gonna do is do 20 sit-ups. Every time I get that, I'm gonna try to change this thing. Or what I did, I read a lot. I read so much. I was just deep diving. So what, I changed my entire landscape of my day. So I got up very early. I read, I wrote down a lot of things, and I redirected my addiction into the addiction of success. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to build a business and put all my effort, energy, time, resources, money into that business. I no longer wanted to get the cue and rush to the casino. I wanted these cues because I believe that now I could really form in changing a habit. And the reward was the best feeling ever, the fulfilling feeling ever. Like, yes, I did something, you know? Yes, I won, and I kept that reward. And you know what? The depression left, right? The sadness left, the stress levels left. Why? Because I didn't actually have to lose anything, lose myself. So I would encourage you to spend some time reprogramming your mindset. And think about commitment like this. The word commitment to me is a promise, obligation. It's a duty to take care of yourself. Now, we could lie to everyone else. We could go around being false to everyone else. But once you can lie to yourself, that's a whole different thing. First of all, if you train yourself on making promises to yourself and then breaking them, no matter how small the promises are, your subconscious, your programming, who you are, will only say, I can't trust you. You make promises. You said that you were going to get up at 5. You got up at 8. You lied again. You're breaking promises with yourself. Think about it. How many times have we broken a commitment, a promise to ourselves? We're going to do A, B, and C. We're going to make sure that we don't eat that thing. When we eat it, it's like nothing. We don't have any discipline. We don't have any power even over ourselves. So we got to learn about getting this power back. Not forget the casinos at this time. Forget your gambling addiction. What about the power and the promises that you have promised yourself that you're breaking daily, almost easily, just very easily? Now, you have to build that up. You have to get better at keeping your promises to yourself. How do you do that? Well, the first thing you could do is start making small promises. Small promises that could build your self-esteem up again, because it's your own self that don't believe yourself. You understand? And if you don't believe yourself, no one's going to believe you. You can't do it. That's why you're in this cycle. And so the first thing I want you to do is make 3 promises that you could actually do. And then do them consistently. The first promise may be something like, tomorrow I am going to wake up at 6 a.m. and I am going to read the 21 affirmations, or I'm going to read a book, or I'm going to write in the journal, and I'm going to write all successful things, all successful habits, all successes that I've had in my life. And then at 8 o'clock, I'm going to jump in the shower, go take a walk. Tomorrow at 6, if you don't do that, you have broken your promise. You have killed that. You have to build this foundation back. You have to start trusting yourself. See, the problem here in terms of gambling is we don't believe ourselves. We want to stop, but we don't. Okay, we've tried, but we can't do it. We failed. So what I want you to do is understand that 100% that you need to start making these promises back so you could actually change the routine. See, what you're doing is focused on the routine. How to build a habit? You change the routine. You don't change the cues. You don't change the reward. Right? You change the routine. You want to build a habit. You give yourself a cue. So this is where it comes in now. It's like, hey, okay, Stace, I could change that habit, but how do I create new habits? That's how you do it. Okay? As soon as the sun comes up, if you want to start going to the gym more, put your shoe next to the freaking bed. As soon as you wake up, you see the shoe, you put on the shoe, you go for a walk. The reward, feeling great, or maybe you have a smoothie in your refrigerator. And then you come home, you have that smoothie. That's your reward. You do that multiple times, and all of a sudden, you see sneakers, you think about, you don't even have to think about it. You don't have to think about it. You just go. You just, oh man, I gotta go walk, I gotta go jog. You come home, your smoothie's right there. You see a shoe. You get up, you see the shoe. Next thing, you just get up. You don't even have to see the cue. That's what happened. That's what happened to Eugene. He's based off of cues now. He doesn't know where he's going. He has no idea, no memory. But yet he finds himself home every single day after his morning walks. That's amazing. And that's why I wanted to share that story. The next part of this, you know, this is a complimentary video, but this is my entire four-step process. This is not anything. This is my best work, so to speak. So we're going to get into the creation side. And what I mean by best work is because it's so true to me of what I've accomplished for myself without Gamblers Anonymous. And honestly, I don't know. And I don't think Gamblers Anonymous is a bad thing. But I just couldn't bear, I just couldn't get myself to go there. My girlfriend said, hey, Stace, you need to call, you need to go speak to someone, this is getting bad. And I was like, no, I just can't bring myself to do it. Maybe it was pride, maybe it was shame, I don't know what it is, but all I'm saying is, I did it by redirecting addiction. And in this creation portion, that's exactly what we do. Below, you will see something that I think that you should take. It's one of these free personality quizzes, but you know, you could pay for a deeper sense and you'll have someone actually be able to read it with you. It's a personality, I wouldn't say quiz or anything, but you get deeper into how people perceive you and you how you are perceived in the world. And it's called How to Fascinate. I have a link below if you want to take some time and understand who you are. Because in this creation process, it's all about creating a lifestyle that works for you and makes you happy. Now that you have freed up all that time, now that you have freed up all that time from gambling, and you're changing your cues and habits, and you're making promises with yourself that you know that if you break, that you're weak. You're just, I mean, it's simply, it's because you are weak. And it's because that you haven't had really the foundation built yet. So you keep at it. You keep trying. Go back to the decision-making portion. Maybe you need to confront more. But this creation portion is because you're like, oh, man, I'm feeling good. I know that this thing is going to work. I know that I am going to invest my time somewhere else. And creation is the best place that you could invest in. Create something. Do something. And that's what I did. I redirected everything and I needed to do something. So I started a company. The company is called Comfort Killers, and that's why I'm able to bring this to other people today. So creating a lifestyle that works for you and makes you happy. I believe in entrepreneurship. I believe in having and owning a business. I don't know if you guys have or own a business. If you do, that's great. Focus back into that. Focus back into creating. Put that energy and time back in your business and get those solutions out to the world. That's what life is all about. It's about bringing commerce, building economies, creating jobs, making families better. You know, they want, you know, going on vacations. They need to be able to pay, put food in their mouths, send their kids off to college, send their kids off to school. It's that type of love life. It's life. And I think entrepreneurship is a product that we create to get more life and to enjoy the luxuries of life. And I am a firm believer that we should all live life to the fullest and to the grandest of life in taking and pulling in the beauties of the world and understanding and loving the value that people are bringing with entrepreneurship, with products, with services, and it's all love. So create that. And if you're not in entrepreneurship, it's great that it's great too. I know you have something that you love to do. And in terms of in decision, you know, when you created and you made a decision and you want this total freedom in life, you wrote down, hey, this is why I'm doing it. This is my motivation. This is my purpose. This is why I'm doing it. So what is that? Go back to that list. Find out, is it your grandkids? Is it your kids? What are you doing it for? And invest that and put that love back in there. And that's creating too. That's creating mass amounts of love and energy and beautifulness and abundance and prosperity and wholeness. That's what that's doing too. So you, in this portion, we're focused on creation. You have gifts and talents that you bring into the world. You have gifts and talents that you're walking with every day. I know someone ever, said to you, hey, you do this thing great. I don't know, maybe it's baking cakes. You bake cakes great. And that's your gift and that's your talent. Some people look at, oh man, I'm a good, I just read the box. No, you have put so much love in that cake that it's more than just a box cake. You know how to bake bread. You know what you're doing. You cook great. You are damn near a chef. And people, whatever people are coming to you and saying, you have to understand that that's God. That's God coming to you and saying, hey, you do this great. I love the way you do this. And you got to understand how powerful that is. So it's all about using the time now, using the energy to define what are your gifts and talents, and then putting that out there, bringing that more to the world, giving it away, right? And when I say giving it away, I don't mean giving it for free. Absolutely not. I mean, giving it away, finally releasing it from yourself and allowing others to experience it in a way that builds and brings you back commerce. Okay. So we spoke about personality. So now I'm going to tell you what's going to happen within this next phase. This usually is a 4-step process. I don't like to do things in weeks, because I think people could at the, You clip, you hear that? They could change like that. Snap of a finger. So I don't like saying, oh, this is your 4-week process to overcome gambling. This is your 3-day process. No, it's when that thing clicks, it's going to freaking click. You're going to feel it. It's going to come to you. Oh, it's going to take over your freaking body, your soul. Ah, you're going to love it. And the reason why I say that is because now it's time to implement. Now it's time to do. We've been talking about a lot of things. We've been writing down some things. But now it's time to really do. Now it's time to wake up every day and put what you have learned in this process here, in this 3 C's of change, to confront, commit, and create. The 4-step process is adding decision in there. So you take what you have learned and really go outside into the world and give it back. And give it back. I mean, just give it. It's such a beautiful thing, because you're going to have a lot of ideas come to you. You're fresh. You're clear now. Once you're clear, once you don't have this stress bogged down to you, you become full of clarity and ideas are going to be attracted to you. Now, this creation portion is very simple. Do. Do so much that you forget the person you was. The person you were. You're going to forget that person. Wake up, you do. Wake up, write, do. Read, do. Go outside, do. Spend time with your family, do. Build a business, do. You know, go back to school, do whatever it is, just do something, because action trumps everything. Now, you know, when I started a company, and I started it by writing a bunch of articles on personal development, because I believe in personal development. I believe in self-improvement. I'm a firm believer that if you invest in yourself, you could do anything that you wanted. So looking back now, I wrote over 230 articles. I've sat with Kevin Harrington, founder of As Seen on TV, sat with Grant Cardone, international sales speaker, I think 5 times best-selling New York Times author, Gordon Bazaar, freaking awesome business leader, entrepreneur, expert. We were on a yacht just conducting the most beautiful conversation. Billie Jean of marketing in San Diego, went to Atlanta, did some talks, spoke up in Cleveland and did 4 documentaries. I never would have thought that my stressed out, depressed out, addicted to gambling ass would have been doing all these amazing things. And you know why? It's because I took freaking action. I didn't sit there and think about it. I didn't sit there and just hum about it. I took action. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing in the beginning. I just knew, man, I had a big, big goal. So the first thing that I want you to do is write down such a scary goal that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because even if you fail at it, you would have become another person. You would have stretched yourself. See, a lot of people have baby goals. These guys write down things that they could easily accomplish. And it doesn't work to their potential. They don't have goals that fulfill potential. They have goals that fulfill whoever they think they were or whoever they think they are. And it differs from promises. What I wanted you to do in a step before in commitment was make smaller promises to yourself so you could keep them, so you could build your self-esteem, build your self-awareness, build your self-trust, build your self-respect, build your commitment to yourself. That's why I wanted you to make small promises. You're going to make bigger promises. The biggest freaking promises, you ain't stepping inside that goddamn casino anymore. You're not going back there anymore. You're not going to bet anymore. That's a huge promise. But you said that before, but you lied to yourself when you made smaller promises. So that's why I need you to start building that trust. But as far as goals, make it huge. Make it so freaking huge that it almost scares you to write it down. And every day you recite it and you work towards that thing. So I've learned, stop making these tiny goals. Make unreasonable goals. Make it big. Make it everlasting. Make a huge change. And today is the day we're going to do it together. We're going to conquer it. We're going to overcome gambling addiction. We're going to understand addiction is a freaking good thing. And we're addicted and we love it. Why? But we're addicted because it actually possesses something beautiful inside us, something that makes us act, it makes us move. We're not cowards, we go for ours, we're clever, we make it happen for ourselves, but we're going to change it from something destructive to something constructive. And in creation part, you're going to find what makes you happy, and you're going to go after it, and you're going to go after it with such force, with such energy, with such Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. It has been an awesome experience with you. I can only hope that you took something from this and able to move forward. Down below, I have an email. If you need to send a testimony, I will be happy to accept your testimony of what this complimentary video did for you. Below that, I also have an accountability program. At this time, it is $1,997 per month to speak with me one-on-one at scheduled times throughout the month, chosen by you. And we go over a process here. It's about 7 hours. And within that 7 hours, each call being an hour, we'll go over different techniques, things that I did not mention here on purpose because it's more of a one-on-one kind of, where are you now? What's happening? Where do you live in relation to the casino, or where do you gamble? You know, what your family is like. So it's more personal. So I couldn't put that here in this complimentary video, but it is in my accountability program. And that's $1,997 per month with a 3-month minimum. if you would like to go into the 3-month minimum package. And that to me is the most powerful, is when you have someone next to you that understands you, that understands the word addiction. It's not scared of the word addiction. You know, we're not here to give each other back pats. We're here to really get down to the meat and the bones and the gristle of this all, so you could go out and start your freaking life. That's it. I want you to go out and start your life. And that's a 50% off. Usually that is a $4,000 product, but right now we're doing it for $1,997 a month. If you're interested in that, the information is below, and I can't wait to chat with you. The only drawback, and it's not really a drawback, it is only make sure that I have the quality calls for people, and I'm doing the best I can to ensure that they have the accountability that they need, is that I limit the accountability program to 3 people per month. That's it. I can't do any more. Well, you know, when we're running businesses, when we're making sure I'm traveling all the time, we're doing documentaries, we're doing a lot of power moves with my company, 3 people is the absolute max that I could take on and speak to for 7 hours each. Okay, so 7 hours per person broken up in 1-hour time slots, that's the absolute max, and I want to make sure that I'm giving the value and I'm providing that beautiful quality and that one-on-one time and making sure that your needs are met. So for 3 people, if you want to take action right now, the information is below, and I can't wait to get started talking to you. Can't wait to get started power throughing, power, getting a power up. You feel that? I want you to remain uncomfortable. I am Stacey A. Cross, and there is no E in my name.